I think we're ready to kick off this session. Today's speakers will explain sustainable funding strategies for watershed groups and outline the process of developing a comprehensive funding plan. Our speakers today are Wendy Wilson and Pat Munoz, both from River Network. Wendy is River Network's Organizational Program Development Director. She has helped grassroots watershed groups with their fundraising efforts for over 10 years. In her program manager position with River Network, Pat works to build sustainable river and watershed nonprofits throughout the country. We have an exciting presentation today, so let's get started. I'll now turn the microphone over to Wendy Wilson. Good afternoon, Wendy. Wendy, are you there? Please unmute your phone.
Hello?
We can hear you. Go ahead. Thanks, Wendy.
Great. Thank you, Ron. Thanks for getting everybody here today. This is great. My job, as you mentioned, at River Network is to help groups become more sustainable, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk to so many groups here at one time. The problem with my job is that every group believes and probably is unique, and so what works for one group doesn't necessarily work for another. So as we go through this presentation today, we'll try to share with you some of our tips and techniques and theories and secrets, but I really like the title slide here for the webcast today because of the fishermen fishing for the little fish with the dollar signs. And Pat and I are going to share with you, like a fisherman, some of our general secrets. But in the long run, you're going to have to learn how to fish the river that you see in front of you, and it'll never be quite the way we say it's going to be. I want to really encourage people to ask some questions of us. Pat has tried everything that we have put together in this presentation for you today over her career with watershed groups, and I've tried some of them. So between the two of us, we can at least tell you what worked for us. So let me go to the second slide. For those of you that aren't familiar with River Network, we were founded 18 years ago, and our mission at that point was just to help watershed groups get started. We do a lot more than that now. We help groups monitor their water quality, enforce environmental laws, the Clean Water Act in particular, and really engage the whole public in protecting rivers and watersheds. One of the things that we've done over the last couple of years is to start a collaborative effort with another group, the Institute for Conservation Leadership at the national level, and a number of state groups that are also available to help watershed groups across the country. We're called the Watershed Support Network, and I'll be referring to a lot of the work that we've done through the Watershed Support Network today. And at the end of the presentation, we have contact information on a state-by-state basis for who you can go to for training and support in your state. And Pat and I will be available by email and phone to help other people with questions after this as well. So we ask you to please contact us if you can. Let's go to the third slide. This slide is really upside down. The most important part of the watershed community that we work with is the blue part at the bottom. River Network maintains the National Watershed Directory for watershed organizations, and we have about 4,200 groups in that directory. We work most intensively with the 700 or so that are partners with River Network that pay their annual $100 partner fees. They are invited to attend the National River Rally, which is going to be held in May, New Hampshire, the 5th through the 8th of May this year. And there's just a tremendous amount of learning that goes on between those 700 partner organizations. So we really invite you to consider becoming a partner of River Network and share with us what you know about this business as well. Let's go to slide 4. Just some background on me. I learned how to fundraise as a Girl Scout and an Earth Day volunteer. I've been an executive director and a fundraiser now for about 25 years And my perspective really is that boards have to understand what money they have to work with for them to really do their mission, to fulfill their mission. There's a term called unrestricted or general fund balance. If your organization doesn't have an unrestricted or a general fund balance at the end of the year, then the board's experience is not going to be very powerful for them. And this is an important thing for groups to grapple with, to understand how they aren't just there to run project grants, that they need to get out and participate in the part of American life that is fundraising. Let's go on to the next slide. This is a pie chart of where money comes from in the charitable sector. This is about gifting or giving money. This isn't, this doesn't include government funding or earned income, which are obviously large sources of funding for a lot of the groups we work with. But the one thing that's very obvious in this pie chart is that in the business of gifting, it's the individuals that are doing the heavy lifting. It's not the corporations or the foundations. While they certainly do contribute large amounts, it is individuals in this country today, and for the last 20 years that we've been tracking this information, that are really doing the financial contributions to nonprofit groups. Let's go to slide six, and you can see where those donations go. We all know that churches get a lot of money. They do a great job of asking and of maintaining their relationships with their donors, as do schools and educational institutions. Poor environment. We're only $7.6 billion a year. How do we ever do it on just $7.6 billion a year? That's the little slice of this pie we want to talk about today. We want to talk to you about how to make the most of that pie in your community and how to make the pie higher in some cases. Let's go on to slide seven. This is a what we call a typical profile. It's a conglomerate of information on groups in the Midwest and in the Southeast that was done by the Mott Foundation, particularly land trusts and freshwater protection organizations. And when you look at this, it seems like there's a fairly diverse fundraising base there, although maybe a little bit heavy on grant income. So much of that grant income is restricted to specific projects that, again, your board of directors just doesn't have much flexibility or wiggle room to expand into new programs, to address emergencies in your watershed, or to kick off new campaigns. So the next slide, slide eight, I want to show you what's more typical for the watershed groups that River Network works with. Over the last couple of years, we've collected data along with the Watershed Support Network partners on where money is coming from for the groups we work with and that are seeking help from us. We found that the median budget for these groups is about $45,000. The chart looks fairly diversified. There's nine different categories here. But most groups are only using four or five or six of these categories. Because the data is combined, these are overall percentages rather than what is really typical of any one given organization. So still we have a heavy reliance on restricted sources of income, particularly government grants with watershed groups. We advise groups that really, if you have more than 40% of restricted income, in the long run, you're going to have some management issues with how you fill out your overhead costs and your research and development costs. So that's a rule of thumb, 40% restricted, 60% unrestricted would be a good place to be for most groups. Let's go to slide nine. A question is your group ready to diversify and increase the money that you have coming in? The trainers with the Watershed Support Network have been collecting data on just where groups are starting from. And we found that most groups aren't really fully ready to launch a strong fundraising program. They first need to have a budget. They need to have an annual work plan. And, of course, we'd like to jump in and say, we'll help you write your fundraising plan, but it takes us a little while to get there. So if you're one of the groups that needs to take some of those first steps, don't worry about it. There's help. As I said, we have at least 10 states where there's a state-based watershed support network group that can provide some one-on-one consulting time, some workshops, some trainings, and at least 12 other states where there's at least an annual conference of watershed groups where you can connect with people and find out what's working in your state. And I'll go over that list at the end of the presentation. Let's go to slide 10. A big question when we start then is, do you have the essentials that you need for fundraising in your organization? The mission statement is obviously the place we begin. It should really read as clearly as a petition. If you're standing out on a street corner, you don't have much time to explain it to somebody. You want to be able to explain who you are, what resource you're trying to protect, and how you work, and where you're trying to make an impact. At the end of a good mission statement, you should be able to say, does that sound like something you would be willing to support? And see some heads nodding. If not, if your mission statement doesn't flow, spend some time with your board going over their elevator speech on who they want to represent and what they want to do and how much they intend to, how they intend to spend the money that they raise, and tighten that up a little. Let's go on to slide 11. An annual work plan of who will do what, and that's assuming you are meeting your budget, of course. But an annual work plan with some clear goals and objectives is an important building block. Obviously, you wouldn't start a watershed project without one, but many groups go into the year without having a work plan that includes their organizational goals, their internal goals, and those are just as important and really need the same amount of attention. And you wouldn't want to be part of the 45% of the watershed groups that don't have one. So please take that step and work towards having an annual work plan before you start your fundraising efforts. Let's go to slide 12. Board of directors, obviously, is very important to an organization, any nonprofit group, a small group of committed people working to change the world. They're not going to be very effective if they aren't also committed to raising the money to do it. So ask your board to evaluate themselves. Do they come to meetings? Do they have enough people to cover all your committees? Do they take on projects and complete them? And is every board member really willing to help out with fundraising at least some level? And we try to encourage groups to really make the commitment and the expectation that everybody's going to help, even if it's as simple as writing thank you notes on letters after donors have submitted money. Everybody can participate. If they don't, it's very demoralizing for the group as a whole, really. Let's go to the next slide, slide 13. If your board doesn't have enough expertise, look into ways to improve it. New ideas are always energizing. So an organization can go to a university or hospital, find a volunteer to help you. You can attend the National River Rally with River Network, or send a staff person or a board member to the Institute for Conservation Leadership's complete fundraiser course. There's a number of things you can do to get outside help, and there's groups like the Environmental Support Center that have funds available just to help you get to those events. So please take advantage of those as you try to launch your fundraising program. Let's go to the next slide. A budget. Budgets are really very simple. This one is an example of a fairly large group. But if your group is smaller, just start with writing down the fundraising history and make sure everyone on your board understands what your immediate needs are and what your past performance is. Discuss that history, look at your work plan, and stick in some money or some numbers in those gaps that you'll fill out and flesh out in a fundraising plan. Don't get bogged down in it right now. Discuss it, amend it, adopt it. At that point, you've made tremendous progress. You're now no longer in the 40% of the groups that don't have a budget. Slide 15, what is a fundraising plan? A fundraising plan is not really a plan unless it's written down, and there's no shame that you're admit that you don't have one written down. 74% of watershed groups don't. So Pat's going to spend quite a bit of time in the next section talking about how to write a fundraising plan. And for now, just be aware that we're going to be asking you to make it as specific as possible with action steps, the responsible persons, and how much and when everything's going to happen. Let's go to the next slide. Slide 16. Before asking for donations, you'll need to know who to send the thank you checks to. So figure out how you're going to keep track. There's a number of different databases that you can use. There's freeware like eBase that you can modify. For a few $100s, you can add on to a FileMaker program, FM server. For a couple of $1,000s, you can get a full package such as DonorPerfect or Paradigm. But you don't need to waste your time figuring out how to spend money before you have money. If all else fails, get some 3x5 cards and don't let it slow you down. Let's go to slide 17. A case statement is something that often slows people down, but is very important if you have some deeper pocketed prospects that you want to approach. A case statement answers the question, do you have something more detailed to send me? And it can just really be two or more pages that goes over a description of the watershed, threats to the watershed, the vision of your organization, your past accomplishments, plans, and methods and philosophy. It can be just that simple. Next slide, slide 18. A lot of questions about nonprofit status, whether you need it, do you not want it, what's it good for. It's still a free country, and anybody can give money to anybody without the government's approval. So once again, don't let this slow you down. There is obviously a lot of benefits to having tax status in the long run. However, don't wait. Some of the best strategies we're going to be talking about today, like auctions and events, a lot of those funds aren't even tax deductible to donors, even if you do have tax status. You can have a larger group accept you as a project, as essentially becoming your fiscal agent. That works for a medium amount of time. This is a lot of work. We've now spent quite a few minutes here, 18 slides, just talking about prep work and staff work, and nobody's asked anybody for any money so far in this presentation. So don't let this work slow you down. We need to get to the important business of asking people. Let's go to slide 19. This one, might seem a little crass. Is this really true? People give out of self-interest? That sounds bad. But you and your board are really going to have to talk about why people give money and why they will give it to you. For starters, think of a specific time that you gave money to a cause. Why did you do it? Just hold that thought for a second and let's go to the next slide, 20. Does your reason for giving fit any of these categories? How did it feel when you said yes? Did it make you feel good? Maybe like you were a responsible contributor to society. It's kind of like having a party. If people find out later that you didn't ask them, then they can feel left out. They can feel disrespected. What, you didn't think they'd be interested? Or what, you thought they'd be too stupid to understand something as important as the work you're doing? You don't actually want to hide your light under a barrel. You want to give people an opportunity to participate in what you're doing. Doesn't make them feel bad. It makes them feel respected, like you care about them. So why don't we ask people more often for money? Well, let's go on to slide 21 and talk about that for a minute. Both organizations and people do give out of self-interest, but they also give because you make them feel good, and feeling good is in their self-interest. We often haven't thought through who would enjoy the benefits of our work. If we're successful, who would win? Is it river outfitters? Is it agencies that are trying to enforce environmental laws? Is it local landowners? Ask yourself, whose self-interest is it in for us to be successful? And those are your prospects. Those are the people you want to approach first. Let's go on to the next slide. If it happens to be a corporation that you're asking, then you are going to have to meet some of their institutional self-interests. If it's a company, they need to tie it to company goals. Here's a few of their company goals. Next slide. Slide 23, agencies. And they have programmatic goals that they need to meet. It's certainly in their self-interest to meet those, and you'll have to tie your work to their programmatic goals. Next slide. Foundations are really no different either, except that they have to tie their requests to the goals of their board of directors. Often it's family members that are on that board who have favorite causes that they want to contribute to. Next slide. Slide 25, I guess. So none of these people are going to come to you and offer you money. Your job is to ask them clearly for it. They can say yes or no based on their own needs and interests, but you've done your job if you've asked them clearly. And we know that money is a taboo subject in our society, and we all use it, but we don't like to talk about it. It's called the fear of fundraising. And if you have that, you're going to have to stretch a little bit. Maybe start with your group doing some simple role playing, like at your next board meeting, and help people become good askers. It's really as easy as selling Girl Scout cookies, which is kind of, like I said, where I started. To be a good asker, all you have to do is four steps. It's just really four little things. One, you explain your motivations. I'm standing there at the door. I say, my name's Wendy Wilson, and I'm a Girl Scout. And then number two, you explain your goal. My goal is to sell 100 boxes of Girl Scout cookies so I can go to camp. And then you specifically ask, my favorites are the Thin Mints. Would you like to buy some? Number four is you shut up and you let them answer. You can show them the cookies, but it's not your job to decide how many cookies they need to buy. That's their job. It's actually a sign of respect that you let the giver decide what their means are, and smile and say thank you. So slide 26, I'm going to talk just a minute about, and then we're going to go to questions here in a couple of minutes. The ladder of effectiveness, how you ask, is very important. Any Girl Scout using this little simple four-step approach can sell cookies at half the houses where somebody answers the door. That's why that fundraising program works. Girl Scouts making phone calls to neighbors will bat more like 1 in 4. Girl Scouts putting up flyers on community bulletin boards saying, call me about cookies, will probably get less than 1 in 1,000 people who walk by. So as a group leader, it's your job to try to set up an annual campaign that uses as many of these techniques as possible at the highest level of effectiveness that you can possibly arrange. You don't want to hurt your organization by taking perfectly good prospects and mailing them letters without any follow-up, and really wasting the opportunity to make that contact with the donors. So your job as a staff person, if you are a staff person, if you're a consultant with groups, is to help them set up who their prospects are, what materials they need to make an effective ask, and give them the training they really need to run a successful campaign. So after the question and answer session, we're going to talk a little bit more about the specific strategies and where they fall on this ladder, but I would turn it over to Ron for that section.
Great. Thanks, Wendy. We do have some questions that have come in electronically. I do remind folks that if you do want to submit a question through the webcast, press the question mark button and type your question, submit it to us. We'll be happy to get to that. One technical note, we've been hearing a few beeps on the lines. Just to let folks know, that is an indication that somebody has either joined us or left us. It's just one of those things with the system, so it's nothing on your end. It's just the way the system works. So let's go to the questions. We'll go on the internet first. Jack has written us in from Connecticut, and he wants to know if you have any advice for attracting new members to your board of directors.
Notice the people that show up. Often the best... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, often the best people to put on your board are the ones that are interested in your organization. You might not think they have the skill set, but maybe you haven't talked to them. Sometimes it's a spouse of a person that's involved in your organization. The people that frequently attend your events, the people that frequently respond to your mailings, those are the most important people to recruit. Probably the most important qualification for being on your board of directors is passion about your cause.
Thanks, Wendy. We also have another request from Jack asking for information on what to include in brochures that you might distribute about your organization.
Well, I think Pat's going to be talking about that a little more. Pat, would you like, can you answer that one for us?
Well, when you're looking at putting together a brochure, first thing you want to do is think about what the purpose of the brochure is. Are you going to use that brochure at outfitter shops and other places like that? Are you going to insert it in a mailing? You always, of course, want to include in your brochure a way for the person that will be looking at the brochure to join your organization. So you always want to have a coupon which spells out how they would, and an address, of course, where they would send that. Other than that, you want to keep the brochure fairly simple and you know, hit the main points in your program. One thing about brochures, if you get very specific, is that they can go out of date very quickly. So you want to be thinking about the kinds of information that won't go out of date too fast, because you don't want to print a lot of those brochures and then have them not be useful. So I think those are the main things. You want to make it very reader friendly, keep a lot of white space so that, because people don't have a long attention span, and so you want to just be sure you stress the major programs or projects that you're doing and give them a means to join your organization.
Thanks, Pat. At this time, I'd like to open the phone lines for those of you who have dialed in today. I will unmute the lines, and again, I do ask, if you don't have any questions, please make sure that your phone line is muted and not put on hold. A lot of organizations have music, and it'll be hard to hear your questions otherwise. So let me unmute, and if you have any questions, if you could identify yourself and say where you're coming from.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm Mary from Connecticut.
Yes, Mary, go ahead.
And with working with Alyssa, and the two of us have a chronic problem, can't get our board to attend fundraising training such as this, and basically the board feels that the staff should do all the fundraising, but we're also running the program, so it makes it tough. We're trying to convince them that they are a part of the fundraising operation. Any suggestions?
Wendy, do you want to take that?
Well, yeah, it's not uncommon. A lot of volunteers get burned out over the years carrying the burden of an organization, and they get staff and they think they can quit doing some of the things that they weren't fond of, and fundraising tends to be one that falls off the list when a group gets staffed. It's important that the staff make the fundraising plan and as really part of the work plan for the organization, and walk through how many hours it's going to take to do all these things and where your funding's coming from and whether or not you really have the staffing to do those kind of jobs. Often groups are so heavily dependent on restricted funds that really their staff is there to run the 319 program. It's not there to serve the general purposes of the organization. So one suggestion is a detailed work plan that includes staff as well as board members. If you have a board work plan, you can take those things that aren't in the staff's job description and put them there. It's really a matter of honest communication, and if those things aren't going to get done, taking them out of the organization's work plan.
Thank you.
And I believe Pat wants to add something to that.
I would just add to what Wendy said that you might think about recruiting on the for your board somebody who specifically has done some fundraising. Often boards don't listen to staff, but if you can get a peer, another board member, who can be talking to them as a peer and just say to them, look, this is the board's job to raise these funds, and we all have to pitch in. Sometimes that might help. And sometimes you can find those experienced fundraisers by looking at universities or hospitals or other organizations that employ fundraisers, and sometimes those people, would enjoy helping a group that really touches their heart and are willing to be on the board and help, as you say, develop a culture of fundraising on that board.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you, and thanks for the question. I would also like to add a reminder to this that this particular webcast is being archived, so the next time you have your board in the room, you can certainly play this the webcast for them and just lock the door, I guess. Any other questions from the phone?
Yes, I had a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Dave Frederick from Maryland, and looking at slide 26, how to ask, I noticed that online is a question mark, and I was wondering what that question mark means. Does it mean that nobody has thought of it, somebody has thought of it and hasn't investigated, someone has tried it and not got any results, or where are we with online asking?
Well, I guess that is tied to the question of how many people are you driving to your website. An online ask is only an ask if people see it. A lot of groups have online membership programs. Groundspring.org does a lot of the research on this, and they've got some very helpful suggestions on how to make your websites more effective. The secret to success is to get people to go. If they're going there specifically to make an online donation, obviously, then you're going to have 100% there. But if it's just posted up there and no one's seeing it, it's not going to do you any good at all.
Okay. Makes sense. Thank you.
This is Pat. I would just add to what Wendy said that, indeed, it is a new area, online fundraising. It's really only been around and been used extensively in the last 10 years or so. And whereas we have a lot of statistics on all these other asking strategies, we still don't have a lot of results yet for online, so it's really hard to put a percentage in there. Also, it just varies tremendously depending on whether you're the Red Cross, which everybody has heard of, or whether you're, the Friendly Watershed Group and have no visibility with the public. So that's why that's still a question.
Okay. That sure makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. At this time, it's about, according to my schedule, to go back to the presentation. We'll move on to slide 28, where it says top funding strategies, and we'll throw it over to Pat.
Thanks, Ron, and hello, everybody, and I'm so glad to be with you today to discuss some strategies that may be useful to you in sustainable funding for your watershed organization. And by sustainable funding, Wendy's already mentioned the idea of being unrestricted. And I would just add in there that we're looking at building a base that is capable of generating resources for your organization to survive and really thrive over time. So slide 28 is heads up this section, and we're going now to discuss briefly eight funding strategies which are commonly used by river and watershed nonprofits in raising funds for more in-depth information on all of these strategies and a lot of others that are out there is available in publications and websites mentioned in the resource page at the end of the presentation. Now, since our workshop today is focused on sustainable funding for watershed groups, we have selected strategies that are reliable and repeatable, that are diversified and are susceptible to growth every year. That is, that these are strategies you can build on and increase the income from each year. They're strategies that build your organization by increasing its visibility and its donor involvement, and that are cost effective for your organization. We've geared our discussion around strategies that raise general operating support, which Wendy mentioned earlier. And this general operating support, the money that you need to keep the lights on and pay the rent and so on, that's the hardest money we find generally for our nonprofits to raise. We've also, though, included some more project-oriented strategies as well, since these are strategies that are commonly used by watershed groups, and they often produce large amounts of very important and necessary project funding. These eight strategies we're going to look at are certainly not the only strategies, but they're a good starting point as you craft a sustainable and diversified funding base for your watershed organization. I do want to take a quick pause here, though, and mention one other strategy which we didn't list in the next slide, but which is, I feel, very important for building a sustainable organization. And it's more of a financial than a funding strategy, and that is budgeting a small surplus for your organization each year. That is, when you make your budget up, you have a little bit more income than you have expenses. And what that will do for you, if you're good at budgeting and can bring in those amounts of money that you have budgeted, it will allow you to create a small surplus, and which you can then stash away each year in a cash reserve. And have that reserve only that can only be used in times of great need. If you do this faithfully every year, you'll eventually build up an operating reserve that you can call upon in times of a disaster such as a fire or a flood or a change in leadership or whatever. All right, now let's get on with these. Let's go to slide 29, and you'll see there that slide lists eight funding strategies which we're going to look at today. Member recruiting, member renewals, special appeals, major donors, events, corporate grants and sponsorships, foundation grants, and government grants. I'm going to talk about the first five strategies which rely on individuals, since, as we saw earlier in one of the slides that Wendy showed us, more than 80% of all private charitable gifts in this country do come from individuals. If your watershed group is not pursuing individual donations in some form, you are probably really leaving quite a bit of money on the table. We'll also look at institutional giving from private corporations and foundations, and finally at public funding from local, state, and federal government agencies. But before we dive into these strategies, let's look at slide 30, which deals with individual giving. Slide 30 highlights some of the interesting data that have been gathered over the years about individuals and how they give. As you read over these findings, think about how you might apply them to your own fundraising efforts. We've highlighted the first one, to stress its importance. That is, volunteers tend to give more than non-volunteers. And what this tells us, of course, is that people who are involved in your organization in some way, whether that be as board members, as water quality monitors, as project volunteers, committee members, those people will tend to make larger and more frequent gifts to your organization than people who merely get your mailings. Speaking from experience, I can say that, and I've worked for several watershed organizations, they have all, in all cases, our largest donors and our most faithful donors were usually members of our board. And why is that? You know, that is because they care deeply. They are very involved, the board members, and they care deeply about what happens to the organization. All right, slide 31 is our first strategy, member recruiting. And slide 31 shows some of the essential things that you need to have in place to be effective at recruiting new members for your organization. Probably all of those are very important, the compelling long-term mission, your board and staff commitment, good prospects, a well-written solicitation materials, some kind of a way to track response to your mailing, and if you're doing large direct mails, which probably not many of you are, some kind of professional advice. Now, how some of the successful recruiting strategies for small groups might include face-to-face asks, which Wendy has talked about earlier, personal phone calls, personal letters, small mailings to targeted lists, small targeted lists such as maybe perhaps a canoe club in your area or a fishing club. Special events can be effective at bringing in new members by asking your faithful board members or volunteers to each bring a friend so you can recruit new members through special events. Speaking engagements, you can sometimes recruit at those. And, of course, your website, using your website as a member recruiting tool. When you're doing member recruiting, you need to be sure to build up your house list, your file of people who have called for information, or who have stopped by your office for a brochure or volunteered at your events. These names are gold, and every so often you should mail a membership solicitation to this list. You may get a response of 10 to 20% on a list like this, while for a large direct mail that you might be doing to, say, the Sierra Club's list, you're probably only going to get about 1 or 2%. Your best prospects for membership are those folks that are closest to you, such as your board members, your volunteers, your friends and colleagues and neighbors. After those come people who benefit directly from your work or who use the resources that you're working to save, such as fishermen, boaters, hikers, and rafting companies, and also riverside landowners. Finally, there are those who benefit indirectly from your work, people who live in your watershed and drink the water from the river. One list you may not have thought about for member recruiting are your lapsed or unrenewed members. When members fail to renew, as many of them will do inevitably, don't completely delete them from your database. Save them on a separate database or list. And when you have a substantial number of these people, you can send them out a new member mailing. They, even though they have not renewed in the past, these individuals will join again at a much higher rate than a list that you've never mailed to before and who are people not familiar with your organization. Slide 32 shows us some of the pros and the cons for building a membership base. A membership program may not be appropriate for every organization. It certainly is not appropriate for a group that has a very short-term mission, such as removing an outdated dam or preventing an unwise development. It requires certain human and financial resources to implement successfully, and it can be an expensive strategy. Most organizations will do very well to break even, and most will lose a little money when they're recruiting new members initially, but they will quickly get this money back through their special appeals and renewals to these individuals. For groups, even with these caveats, though, for groups who plan on being around for the long haul, who want to become a sustainable, a membership base provides an invaluable source of reliable and unrestricted income that can be used to build your organization in many other ways. Wanted to just mention that you must be sure to thank all your new members for joining and for any other gifts, of course, that they may send. Kim Klein, one of the gurus out there for grassroots fundraising, always says, thank before you bank. And so right away. and consider sending them, new members, some kind of a welcome package to make your group stand out in their minds. Slide 33 shows a member recruiting website. Websites are important tools, of course, for recruiting membership support. But as someone has said earlier, you have to draw people to your website with interesting features, such as listings of community events or cultural amenities in your watershed before you even have a crack at recruiting them. Then you must provide them with an easy way to join your organization, preferably right there online. And be sure you offer people some giving choices. As you can see in that slide, there are several of those different categories that people can give at. You just never know when someone who's on your clicked on your website may fall in love with your group and write that first $1,000 check. Slide 34 illustrates our second strategy, member renewals. And here, the essentials, of course, are listed there. You need the resources, of course, to maintain your database. You need a good program for informing and involving your members and a good system for sending out a series of renewal notices. You shouldn't even consider our first strategy, that is member recruiting, unless you are very, very committed to the second strategy because it's such a hard work to bring these members in the door to begin with. To do renewals, you need a good system that helps you keep track of when people are due to renew, if you have that good system, you'll probably get somewhere between 65 and 80% of your members to renew each year. Your renewal rates will vary, with the lowest coming from the new members and the highest from those who have been with you for several years. To get these kinds of results, you're going to need to send out between 3 and 5 renewal notices each year to your members. And of course, as people renew, you'll remove their names from those that you send your notices to. But you will find that you'll continue to get quite a few people to renew even on your second and third notices. So one renewal notice to your members is not enough. You must communicate regularly with your members in order to keep them. So you should try to communicate at least 6 to 8 times a year in addition to your requests or your renewal notices that you're sending out. Your contacts with it can include your welcome letter, your thank you notes, your newsletters, invitations to events, annual reports, and so on. Slide 33 shows the pros and the cons of a renewal program. I think you can see it's pretty obvious that renewals will provide you with steady and reliable sources of income, and it is a strategy that allows you to build on your past success. This is slide 35. Hopefully your base of loyal, committed members will grow every year. And this is a challenge because despite your best efforts, you're going to only retain about 65 to 70% of those people. To keep your membership growing, you're going to need an aggressive recruitment program as well as a top-notch renewal program. Slide 36 shows a sample renewal letter. Renewal letters don't have to be great works of art, but you do want to be sure to stress the importance of renewing your membership several times at the beginning of your letter and again in your closing. Generally, response to renewal letters is usually higher than response to a simple appeal because as we discussed earlier, people like the feeling of belonging to an organization or an initiative. Using your board letterhead on these membership renewals and special appeals as well can add credibility to your request. If you're lucky enough to have a foundation or a corporation or even an individual donor who has offered to make a matching gift, you can also include that in a PS, and that can increase response to your renewal mailings. Again, be sure to thank your members every time they give, and consider recognizing them by listing them in your newsletter or your annual report. Slide 37 illustrates another of our strategies, and lists the requirements for this strategy. You will need a membership or donor base to mail to, of course, a compelling project and a well-written letter. Special appeals are one way to capitalize on your base of loyal members. Although you can also send out special appeals to targeted lists of people who are non-members as well, if you're not a group that for which having a membership is appropriate. The very best time to send out a special appeal is near the end of the calendar year, around mid to late November. But you can use appeals successfully at other times of year as well, particularly if you have an urgent and compelling need. Tips for writing good appeal letters, in addition, of course, to presenting your need very concisely and well, include making your letters look as personal as possible, indenting your paragraphs, using sentences that are short and concise, avoiding the use of jargon like TMDLs or riparian corridor, talking in plain language, and using a PS at the end of your letter to motivate the reader. Slide 38 shows the pros. In this case, we couldn't even think of any cons for special appeals. And, you know, again, they're dependable, unrestricted funding usually, quick turnaround time, and they're good for educating your membership. Many groups with large memberships send out a special appeal almost every month to some segment of their membership. I really think that for the groups that are probably listening in today, up to 3 special appeals a year is probably a good rule of thumb. In addition to bringing in funds, as we said above, they're great for educating your members about key issues. Slide 38 shows an example of an online special appeal that was sent out recently by the Potomac Conservancy. Commonly used themes for special appeals can include your end of the year accomplishments and challenges. The appeal can highlight a special need or a threat. It can highlight a matching opportunity, an anniversary appeal, a holiday or literary theme such as the one used above in slide 39. An appealing, easy-to-use premium offered for a specific amount can often significantly increase the number of large gifts given to a special appeal. And if you notice in that example above, there is a PS there offering a premium. Slide 40 refers to our fourth strategy, and one of the big payoff strategies for all the hard work you've done in building your membership base, major donors. This is where you really can capitalize on your membership base by turning a certain percentage of your members, usually about 10%, into major donors. Major donors are usually members who contribute from $100 to $1,000 or more annually. You will need to decide for yourself, for your organization and your community, what amount you want to set as a minimum for your major donor for people. Major donors tend to be extremely loyal and have very high renewal rates, around 80% usually, and they often increase their gifts year after year. With major donors, the name of the game is developing meaningful relationships and involving these donors in the organization in some way, if possible, and also finding out what aspects of your program interest them, so that you can personalize your requests to them. Thinking back to our ladder of effectiveness in giving, this is where you really want to make an in-person ask, or at least call them personally on the phone, or write them a personal letter. Again, major donors should be thanked promptly and also recognized in your annual report, your newsletters, and other publications, unless, of course, they ask to remain anonymous. The slide 41 shows some of the necessary requirements for a major donor program and illustrates the pros and cons.
for a well-thought-out major donor program. Slide 42 is a gift table, which reflects the need for and it reflects the need for more prospects in the initial stages of building a donor program than actual donors. For example, to recruit two $5,000 donors, you'll need at least four good prospects. A good prospect for a major donor program usually has three characteristics: A, the ability to give; B, belief in your cause; and C, a connection to your organization or to you. If you ask someone with all three of these elements for a gift in person, you've got a very good chance that they will say yes. Now we're going to look at our final individual strategy in slide 43, events. And that slide illustrates what you will need for a special event. Your special event should be appropriate, repeatable, and have other benefits besides just bringing in money, such as generating publicity or new members. A few tips for special events include starting small, developing a budget and a timeline and a to-do list, keeping your costs low to maximize revenue, engaging a group of board members or volunteers to organize the event, and being sure to evaluate what went right and what went wrong so that you can do better year after the next time you do your event. In slide 44, we can see some of the pros and cons for special events. They can be great fun, very creative, and they can bring in good, unrestricted, repeatable funding, but they can be risky. One thing to think about there is developing a signature event for your organization that embodies many of your organization's principles and that people can look forward to every year. And finally, slide 45 presents an example of one feature of an event which often attracts crowds: good food. And in this example, you can see that using local foods is a very appropriate strategy for this rural action organization and provides a hook for getting media attention as well. So don't forget to use your website to publicize your event well in advance to excite your members and create a buzz and also attract newcomers. All right. Thank you. And I pass to Ron.
Great. Thanks, Pat. We'll continue on with this train of thought, and we'll give it back to Wendy.
Hi. Am I there?
You are there.
Good. Thanks, Pat. That's great. As I said, Pat's done this for so many years. If people have specific questions, I'm sure you'll email her or contact her. I'm going to go through our last three strategies briefly, starting on slide 46, and I'm going to tell a few stories on myself, I guess. The best person I can tell stories on. And I have a couple of case studies that I'd like to share with you as well. Number one, on business, corporate grants and sponsorships. Obviously, businesses like to make good investments. They would like you to have a clearly written package of materials that explains who you are and how well managed and balanced you are, and have a specific ask in that package that specifically tells them what they're going to get in return, because the cookies that most businesses want are really opportunities for public recognition. So you need to explain it to them in numbers. How many flyers are you going to distribute? How many billboards are you putting up? How many newsletters will you list them in? Those are the currencies of business support that they understand. And there's a couple of quick tips with businesses. Hit them earlier in the year when their marketing budgets are bigger, and go to a lead business to get started. Usually communities that are, well, all of the communities I've worked in, big and small, have sort of a hierarchy of corporate givers, and they know who they think should be the lead corporation in any particular ask. Let's go on to the next slide, 47. One of the things we found out in researching the groups that are asking us for help through the Watershed Support Network is that only about 20% of our watershed groups have any business or corporate support at all. So this is a huge opportunity for groups to improve their fundraising plan by going out of their way to start a new corporate or business donor program. For those that do have business support. It can be a large portion of their funds, from just a few percentage points all the way up to 75%. Usually those would be smaller groups that would have a larger percentage of corporate donations. But with some of our larger groups, it's not unusual for them to find corporations that are willing to spend tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands sponsoring a watershed improvement project. And for that reason alone, it's really worth it for you to spend some time getting to know the corporate opportunities in your community. Often corporate grants can be used to match federal dollars, and, you know, often you can't think of a way to make that much money for your match requirement without corporate support. Let's go on to the next slide. This is a Patagonia's website. A lot of the companies that specialize in what they call low-cost marketing sector, the lifestyle of health and fitness, is a marketing sector where corporations are interested in making contributions to environmental groups, and they will have websites, they will have solicitation procedures. But most of the business contacts in your community probably don't have websites or guidelines even on how to approach them. And you have to, in that case, if they don't have a contributions officer even, you have to go to the top. So my first story on myself is that once upon a time I was so desperate to fund a wild salmon education program. Nobody would give me any corporate money to do it. It seemed like an obvious one for corporate support. They were afraid that the power company would object because the local power company was heavily invested in hydropower. So I called up the CEO's office of the Idaho Power Company, the largest hydropower dam, private dam operator in the country. They had cut off a third of the wild salmon habitat in the Columbia River system, and I asked to speak with the CEO about making a donation to save salmon. I was amazed when he said yes, and even more amazed when he donated to the program. And with their lead group, with their lead donation, I was able to go to other companies and get more money for the program. So the moral of my story is, go to the person that can help you. That person may be a person at the top of a company. It may be someone that you know within the company. But you just have to have no pride when it comes to finding out who can help you. Let's go to the slide 49. Even if you don't get a big cash donation, in-kind donations are wonderful, good stuff as well. And in some cases, that is what groups are most successful at getting out of corporate and business sponsors. So keep an updated wish list printed in your newsletter. And as Pat said, let people have lots of recognition if they want it for making those donations. Always ask before you do recognize those donations. I've had a little bit of problem with, say, like print shops that get inundated with too many requests, and they don't want anyone to know that they give. Slide 50, we're going to talk about foundations a little bit. This is an important part of a balanced fundraising plan. Obviously, foundations can only give to tax-exempt charities, but beyond that, they can only give for non-lobbying expenses, and they cannot be associated with any sort of electoral activity or candidates for public office. Those are important rules not to violate when you are asking them for contributions. You don't want to start out by saying something that might violate that first rule. However, just because foundations can't give to lobbying causes, you can still lobby as an organization. So I have seen some misconception with some groups that think that if they're going to go to foundations, they have to swear off lobbying, and that's not true, actually. So please don't let that be a hindrance to you. Slide 51, some of the pros and cons on foundation support. Certainly they're large chunks of money, even if they're not the 80% as we've been talking about in terms of the pie chart of where money comes from. Foundations are a smaller piece of the pie, but it comes in larger chunks. It's important to ask for general support first, because you can always reallocate general support to specific projects if you need to. But make sure that you've asked them first if they will consider general support. Only about 30% of our groups actually, the groups that come to us for help, currently have foundation funding. So this is an area of some potential growth, but because it is not necessarily reliable from year to year and often is restricted, it is only part of a diverse fundraising plan. River Network has a quarterly fundraising alert that we publish for our partner groups that goes into the actual deadlines for relevant foundations on a state-by-state and regional basis. And so you certainly, as a partner group of River Network, you should take a look at those on a quarterly basis. But your best bets for family are, for foundations are really with family foundations or community foundations. They are the ones that in your community that are going to care the most. If you're trying to go for national foundations, they're going to be looking for those cutting-edge projects that are setting national precedents, and that isn't always relevant to every watershed group. Next slide, 52, is an example of a website for the a large foundation, Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, that is a good website for that foundation. Almost all of the larger foundations have websites. The Foundation Center website is actually a great place to start your search for private foundations. River Network also has a searchable database on our website for our partner groups. But foundation research is something that you can spend more time on than you necessarily want to. I want to just tell one more story on myself about acting without research and sometimes just having a theory of, you know, who's going to give you money, and maybe a couple of theories can lead you into some great situations and put you in touch with some foundations that wouldn't turn up in a web search. I have a theory, and it's well proven out over the years, that the frequency of donations that you get from a donor is a good indication that they are a good prospect for larger contributions. And an additional theory is that if someone gives you a single gift at just on impulse, just because you asked and they said yes the first time, that in fact they could probably, if you thoughtfully develop them as a donor, they could probably make a donation that's 10 times larger than that. So those are my theories. I'm working on the theory. I noticed that one of my donors has written me a $100 check 3 times in the last year in response to our special appeals. I call the guy up and I say, thanks, wow, I'd love to meet you sometime. We should talk. He says, sure, drop by and see me sometime. I say, great, I'll do that. I find myself in the neighborhood. I go visit him at his house. I'm thinking, boy, if I get up my nerve, I'm going to ask him for $1,000. Well, the conversation turns out he mentions that he has a family foundation. And I say, oh, well, what size of proposals does your family foundation consider? Completely ignorant. He says, 3,000, 3 million, what do you need? So I quickly think the largest donation I've ever received is $40,000. So I double it. I ask him for $80,000 on the spot. He says, yes. I'm just amazed. I walk away. I can't believe this has just happened to me. I go back. I look him up. I do the research. I find out his foundation doesn't do environment. If I had just gone to the website, I would have not even asked him. So my theory, frequency of giving is an important thing to look at in your database. And if they can give you a one-time donation on impulse, think of increasing them by a level of magnitude if possible. So let's go to the next slide, and I just wanted to say briefly that a little bit about government grants. Government grants are an important part of river and watershed conservation groups' fundraising plans. About 58% of the groups that have submitted information to us about their fundraising plans use some kind of government grants. That includes state and local programs, as well as USDA, EPA, DOI, DOE, Army Corps of Engineers. Probably the EPA 319 funds are the most heavily used. About 20% of the groups that I've surveyed say that they have been using those. But really, government grant opportunities vary widely from state to state. 15 states have their own watershed support funding that the legislature has allocated, including such an unlikely place as West Virginia. So it's very important to have a sense of your government grant opportunities based on a state. In Montana, we compiled a list of 19 different programs that watershed groups were using in the state of Montana. Probably the biggest growth area in government grant opportunities right now is in local government, including Phase 2 stormwater, community information and education programs. And for those of you that are into researching further on government grants, the resources at the end have some great links into OWOW and EPA and the Environmental Finance Centers, where there's just some great opportunities to see what's available. Let me go quickly over slide 56. The Combined Federal Campaign is a small piece of some of our watershed groups' fundraising plans. EarthShare and the Community Share organizations around the country also include watershed groups in their programs. And for some of the information on that, one of the good resources I've noticed is the National Committee on Responsive Philanthropy. NCRP.org has some great resources and research on ways that local groups can get into not just workplace giving, but other foundation and corporate giving as well. So I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes on a couple of case studies. The first one on slide, 57, Roaring Fork Conservancy website. This is a larger group in Colorado, Basalt, Colorado. It's 10 years old. They have had a budget now of over $500,000 a year for a couple of years. Their biggest growth took place in years 3 and 4 of their existence, really. They sort of leveled out at this point. This is sort of what I would consider an ideal situation that people might look for. It's a case study of a successful group that have managed to become sustainable at a level that's somewhat higher than many of our groups have accomplished. About a third of their budget is from grants, and those grants change from year to year. Sometimes they have zero foundation money. Sometimes they have zero government money. About a third of their budget is from individuals, and another third is from events. They have, like Pat mentioned, the signature event, the River Rendezvous. It capitalizes on all the little events that they do over the year to develop some community support for the watershed, and then brings together the business donations and the community support and their major donor support into one big event where they make a good portion of that budget each year. Their major growth opportunities that they see are in the fee-for-service programs, particularly contracting out their water quality monitoring expertise, and also in business support, where they're trying to establish an outfitter pass-through with some of the fly fishing shops in town. So they continue to grow, but at a lower rate than they used to, and they're still adding new elements to their fundraising plan. They'll be launching a capital campaign in the near future for an educational building. Their advice, the executive director told me today when I was talking to you, tell people to let them in on the passion. You have a lot of passion for your work, and not every communication with your prospects should be about a crisis, but people need to understand why you care and understand about the watershed. And I think that's good advice. Spend one quick minute on a smaller organization. I'm not going to ask you to go back to slide 33, but on slide 33, Pat showed you the Valley Stewardship Project website, which is in Wisconsin and works on the West Fork of the Kickapoo River. And I'll just, you don't need to go back, but I'll just refer to their experience, much smaller operations. They're 6 years old. They have a $30,000 budget. They also do water quality monitoring and cleanups and community planning, visioning type events. but they just have a part-time staff and an active board of 6 volunteers. They feel that they are sustainable because they have $12,000 in the bank in unrestricted general fund balance. And that is almost 50% of their budget from 1 year to the next. As their budget, again, is subject to, this year they have foundation funds, next year they don't, but their core funds come from their end-of-the-year mailing, their quarterly newsletter, and their auction events. Their coordinator told me that the secret to their success was that they decided to bootstrap off of a major investment made by Trout Unlimited in the watershed a number of years ago in their Home Rivers initiative, which developed a great mailing list and a lot of community-based partner organizations that they could work with. So that's where they're going. In the future, they're going to build their small donor base and plan a benefit concert, and continue their fundraising plans as a sustainable organization at about the $30,000 a year level. And I'll turn it over to Ron.
Great. Thanks, Wendy and Pat. It was great to go through those strategies, and you certainly have stimulated some thoughts in others who are interested in hitting the jackpot as well. Wendy, your story about the power company CEO kind of evokes in me the Mr. Burns character from The Simpsons, where once you get through the gate, if you get through the gate, you have to avoid the hounds before you can even talk to the guy. And Robert writes in from Ohio wanting to know, how exactly did you get in touch with the CEO? How did you get through all those pitfalls to reach this person?
Oh, well, I guess it must have intrigued him when he saw that I just called his secretary. They had a corporate contributions officer who basically just shook me off. But the CEO was a fly fisherman and really didn't want his company to be hung with the long-term legacy of destroying the salmon. So I just called the secretary. I really felt like I had to tell my board the program was dead if I didn't go to what the problem was, and that was Idaho Power's what the community considered their opposition. I wasn't convinced that they would actually oppose what we did if they saw it in detail, and I was right.
Okay, and the next question is, I guess, directed more toward Pat. Danielle from West Virginia writes in, and Pat, in the previous slide, you had indicated the size of gifts, a range of gifts that you might be asking for, and Danielle wants to know, how do we determine the specific ranges or levels that you're going to, the categories that you might be asking?
Well, determining those categories is going to depend on the community where you live and what people are capable of giving, certainly. So you want to gear them somewhat to what other organizations in your community are asking for. It's a little bit arbitrary in terms of just offering people a good range of choice, so that if you do find somebody that's capable of making that $500 gift, there is a category at that level that the funny thing about people when they give is that they often will give what they see or what they're asked for. So if you don't put that $500 category on your coupon, you're probably never going to get that amount. That's about as far as I can go in thinking of how you establish those levels.
Great. Thanks for those answers. We do have time for maybe one or two max questions from the phone lines. Let me unmute the phone. And if you could say your name and where you're calling from.
And my question actually has to do with endowments. When you talk about sustainable funding, I think of endowments per se in terms of instead of going after grant every year and having to do applications. I just wondered if there was some experience regarding that. And I do know certain grants are restricted, so you can't use that money to set up endowments. But are there other grants out there that allow for that?
Hey there.
Pat, should I start? I would say that your best prospect for endowments are foundations and or donors that are already giving you large amounts. The problem, of course, then is you're taking them out of general support and putting them in endowments. So usually before you start an endowment drive, you're going to want to do a full feasibility study on what your donor base actually is. It's very hard to get a single individual endowment donation that's going to meet your goals, I guess would be my first observation. It's certainly a place that you want to end up in, either a capital campaign or endowment to support your organization. But unless your organization has been around for decades and you have a large donor base, it's not always appropriate. Pat?
Yeah, I would just echo what Wendy said. I think that that was the reason, basically, I mentioned the operating cash reserve and the importance of establishing that. And I think before you even think about an endowment, you need to have a very, you know, a good cash reserve with policies governing the use of that money that you know, that will serve, in a lot of cases, some of the same kinds of functions that an endowment might serve. We do have some information on that River Network website about endowments. It is, as Wendy said, a strategy for groups that have been around for a while. You need to have a large base of individual donors before you even think about an endowment. You know, I would just pick a number out of the air, at least 1,000 members and probably a lot more than that, and a good major donor program in place. So it's really a strategy for groups that are quite far along and generally in their development of their fundraising base.
I have a question. My name is Amy Brown, and I'm from Evansville, Indiana. And we have a large organization similar to the Roaring Fork Conservancy, and it does have, we've been around for 30 years. But we have seen a huge lack in memberships, as well as what we used to get are a lot of wills, a lot of giving after deaths and estates. And is there a way to kind of, encourage that again? I mean, and just, our board of directors has changed a lot, and we're just trying to get back. It's like we're having growing pains and get back into the groove of where we were at. Do you have any suggestions as to kind of, kind of pumping that back up into the community? And
well, let me try. Certainly, you'll want to do an assessment of your overall donor program. Pat has some very simple assessment tools that we often use, just questions and answers or sort of a benchmarking type process for what you're doing and not doing in your membership program right now to see maybe where some of your services could be improved. It's a much more competitive market now than it was 10 or 20 years ago for bequests. And I imagine that if you have been around for a number of years, some of your original donors may have already passed on or may have been approached by other groups that are also of interest to them. So I think a full assessment is probably necessary. And then also, as Pat suggested, getting someone on your board that is familiar with giving in the area and is active in the community and can show you new opportunities that you might be missing. I don't know, Pat, anything else?
Pat is shaking her head no. At this time, I'm going to mute the phones again. We will continue with the presentation. We're now on slide 59, dealing with funding planning and resources. I'll turn it back over to Pat.
Well, we're going to talk now a little bit about planning and resources. We're going to discuss the importance of developing a fundraising plan for your watershed organization, and what the components of such a plan might be, and what steps you need to take in developing it. And finally, we're going to provide you with some specific resources that you can use for further research and learning. Slide 60 illustrates two kinds of funding bases. And I might throw the question out there, which of these does your organization's fundraising base look most like? Pyramid B shows a group that makes that may make enough money this year, but it is much more vulnerable and unstable because so much of its funding is coming from contracts and grants, which may or may not be renewable from one year to the next. It takes years of intentional effort to create a stable funding strategy for your group, such as that illustrated in Pyramid A, where you have a broad base of individual donors at the bottom of the pyramid, and then smaller amounts in the grants and contracts area, and finally up at the top, those very large one-time gifts which you might stash away in your cash reserve or even in your endowment. Slide 61 takes us into the realm of fundraising planning. By creating a document, as Wendy mentioned, that is written and that intentionally builds a base of reliable, diversified, unrestricted sources of support, along with other sources that may not be restricted or repeatable, you will certainly be helping to guarantee the financial future of your organization. Slide 62 lists the strategies that we've looked at so far and which you may want to consider as you develop your fundraising strategies and planning. Obviously, if you're a new organization, you're not going to choose all of these strategies at once. The trick here is to choose a few of the most appropriate strategies for your organization and then to develop a good plan for carrying them out. On slide 63, we see the components of a fundraising plan. For each strategy that you choose, you're going to develop goals, activities, and other details such as who's the responsible person or persons, when this activity or activities will occur, and a very important piece, how much this strategy or this activity is going to cost you so that you're sure to include enough funding in your budget to carry out the activities you want to undertake. In slide 64, we see the difference between goals, which are what we want to achieve, and activities, how we are going to go about achieving this goal. In this case, a nice example, the goal is recruiting 250 new members, and the how is holding an event, putting ads in our newsletters, doing a small membership mailing, and so on. So those are the activities. Slide 65 gives us an example of what one little piece of a fundraising plan might look like. Here in this example, we've chosen member recruiting as the strategy, and we've set some goals, recruiting 250 new members and bringing in $9,000. And then we have outlined the activities that we're going to undertake to reach that goal. We've specified who is going to undertake each of the activities. And finally, we've assigned a time and we've put some funding in there to carry out that activity. Carefully thinking through all of these elements and assigning a time and a responsible party can be time consuming. But in the long run, it's going to pay off for your organization. Now we're going to go through some of the steps, starting with slide 66, which illustrates the first step, and that is reviewing your fundraising history. Reviewing your past fundraising history it may be hard to do. Sometimes it's hard to go back and find these numbers, but it will really give you a reality-based place to begin putting together your fundraising plan. Keeping good records is very important in fundraising, and having this history is extremely helpful because it allows you to see the trends and, as I say, to base the numbers that you come up with for a given year in some kind of historical reality. Step two, which is shown in slide 67, illustrates that how you're going to begin to, once you've got your history, how you're going to begin to put together your plan. You need also to analyze and review strategies that you've pursued in the past with your board, involve your board, your staff, and your volunteers in discussing this and coming up with either strategies that have done well in the past or new strategies that may do well for your organization. So getting that input and buy-in from your stakeholders is very important as you put together this plan. In slide 68, we see step 3, which is surveying your fundraising assets. This is going to help you pull in assets that you have available to build a successful fundraising plan. And it's really closely allied with the previous step and can be done at the same time that you're reviewing your past strategies. Here you want to be thinking about fundraising assets in two categories, institutions and individuals. And once you've done that, you can break them down even further into entities and brainstorm the assets that each entity might have to offer. And I think this will be clear as we look at slide 69, which gives a nice example of how we might go about doing this kind of a survey. In this case, the holiday membership campaign is the strategy that we're focusing on here. And we see that some of the breakdowns here, the existing membership, the print shop owner, these are the categories of assets. And then under each of those, you can see some of the kinds of things that we might consider fundraising assets or we might use in carrying out our fundraising plan. For example, the print shop owner, we might ask that individual to donate some free printing for the holiday solicitation. The neighborhood organizations and places of worship might be willing to publicize the campaign to their members and congregations. So this careful way of thinking through what assets you have often turns up things that you may not have thought of and helps you really incorporate your a lot of your stakeholders into your fundraising campaigns. Slide 70, step 4, illustrates step 4, which is then going forward and selecting the strategies you're going to use for the current year. And in the example there, this organization has selected 4 strategies to focus on, and they've selected their goals and their budgetary goals as well as other goals that they might have, such as how many new members, what kind of renewal rate, and so on, that they want to attain within these various strategies. There are various questions to ask yourself as you go about selecting these strategies. Some of the most important ones are, you know, does this strategy really fit with the mission of our organization? Will our constituencies respond well to this strategy? Do we have the resources to carry it out? Is it going to build our organization? And how does this strategy take advantage of our special assets, and does it fit well with other activities that we have planned? Slide 71 is a graph which you might want to keep in mind when you're choosing your strategies. And here you can see that one of the axes is predictability of funding, going from less predictable up to more predictable. The other axis is flexibility, starting with very restricted funding and going out to the right and to unrestricted dollars. So you need a good mix of strategies, but you want to keep in mind to build a sustainable base of funding that you want to choose enough of those strategies out in the predictable and unrestricted arena to enable you to pay your ongoing core operating expenses while at the same time incorporating other strategies which may be lower on those two axes, but which will pay for your project costs. Achieving a good mix of strategies which balances out both the need for that unrestricted money and the need for larger sums of money to pay for projects may take you a long, several years to achieve. Slide 72 illustrates step 5 in putting your plan together, fleshing it out. And here is where you want to include detailed information that will really base your plan and connect it to reality. And in the above example, which is just is for a strategy for building your foundations, you want to be sure that you incorporate enough foundation income in there to really meet your goal of $18,000. It would be easy to just stop with the Black Family Fund and assume that you're going to get that $25,000 grant. But since in this case the Black Family Fund is a new foundation, there's no real certainty that the grant will be awarded, you really need to put the predictability of getting that grant fairly low and to add other foundations in there so that you will be sure that you make that $18,000 goal. So you can see what we've done in this example is to discount each of those foundations by a percentage that helps us come up with a much more reality-based forecast. Slide 73 illustrates step 6, again, very important, involving all of our stakeholders from the board to the staff and even our volunteers in getting buy-in. So very important to run this plan by them, get their approval, make them aware of what it is, and as Wendy mentioned earlier, making them aware where they have a role to play, and they probably will have a role in most of the strategies you select, and getting their buy-in in terms of approving this plan. If you do this, it will help you build a fundraising culture in your organization. Slide 74, once you've got your plan, you want to prepare a fundraising calendar. And this example shows, let me step back. The importance of having a calendar is probably pretty obvious. It will allow you to schedule at least one major income activity per quarter, or better yet, per month, so that you'll have a steady stream of income rather than having your funds come in big bursts or all at once at the end of the year. By spacing out your fundraising work, you'll do a better job, be able to do a better job on each activity and be more likely to accomplish your goals. The organization will, through having a calendar, establish a fundraising culture, which regards fundraising as an ongoing day-to-day part of your activities. This will put you in an obvious advantage over groups with a crisis mentality who put fundraising off until there's no money. And this particular calendar only really specifies when those activities are going to be accomplished, but there are other kinds of calendars might spell out in much greater detail what activities are scheduled for each month. Slide 75 illustrates step 8, which is integrating your fundraising events and activities into your organizational calendar. So you want to be sure that you plot your fundraising calendar on a timeline with your major organizational activity to see where work is most intensive and to determine how best to allocate your resources, and also to look for ways to combine your fundraising activities with your other organizational activities. For example, we can see in this example how we might possibly tie our Earth Day activities to our new member campaign by timing them close together. Or how we can use the fall newsletter and the annual meeting to expand upon our holiday appeal. Slide 76, step 9, is our final step in the process evaluation. Keeping good records of all your fundraising activities so you can compare them from year to year and make improvements is really one of the big secrets to successful fundraising. Consider keeping a three-ring binder with all copies of your fundraising letters. And you should then note on each of your letters when it went out, how many pieces you mailed, how much money each one generated, how many responses, and so on. If you do this carefully, you will create a great record that you can go back and look at. And it's also a great idea to have a debriefing with your committees after a special event to find out what went right and wrong while the event is still fresh in everybody's minds. And that brings us to our final slide, our resources. You can click on this link here and come up with a nice link of additional resources that you can use to explore further fundraising strategies, as well as the ones we looked at today, as well as other strategies that may be appropriate for you. I'm not going to go into any detail here, but I will mention that the catalog of federal funding sources for watershed protection will give you good information on government grants. The Grassroots Fundraising Journal has great information on membership and events. We've mentioned the Foundation Center. They are wonderful for foundation and corporate resources. And Groundspring is a great resource for online fundraising. Finally, two more down at the bottom there. The Institute for Conservation Leadership has some outstanding fundraising trainings, and the Environmental Support Center has some actual small grants and funding available for fundraising and other kinds of capacity building activities that you might want to undertake. And now I'm going to pass the baton to Wendy, who's going to talk about River Network's support organizations.
Hi, am I there?
You are there.
Good, thanks. Thanks, Pat. I'm not sure, I think before we move to the next slide, I'll just on the resource page, you'll notice that the third button down is a listing of watershed, River Network listing of watershed support services. And that is a Word document that has email contacts by state and region for people that might be able to help you with some personalized help or training in fundraising or organizational development specifically based around their work in watershed groups. On the next slide, slide 78, you'll see where we have services. River Network, of course, is a national organization, so if your state is in dark green, call me or Pat, and we would be your primary contact. What we would do if we talked to you or we got an email from you is that we would probably send you a 2-page short-form needs assessment, is what we call it, which helps us determine what your training needs are, what your skills and abilities are, and then we would try to find someone that could advise you in those areas in particular. If you are in one of the states on slide 78 that is in bright yellow or light yellow, we have active programs in the Watershed Support Network, which, as I mentioned, is a collaborative effort between capacity builders that are helping watershed groups. And if you're in one of the lime green states, you at least have an annual conference that you can go to and a network of people that would like to help and network with you to find out how we can bring some of the national trainers in at very least to help with your training needs. So once again, I'm at wwilson@rivernetwork.org and Pat is at pmunoz, M-U-N-O-Z, @rivernetwork.org, and we'd love to hear from you. On the last page, I just have some quick acknowledgments and kind of a final pep talk. The OWL staff has been great to work with, and I can't tell you how much I've appreciated doing this project. The important thing for everyone on this call to realize is that local groups are really doing important work, and it's very important that your community be given the opportunity to get involved with what you're doing. Regardless of what happens at the national or international level, it really does come down to what local groups are doing on the ground, what the future of this earth looks like. So do good work, stay in touch, and let River Network know how it goes.
Great. Thanks, Wendy and Pat. If you advance your slides one more, we're now on slide number 80, which is our final slide, the question slide. We do have a few minutes to answer some additional questions, but before we do that, I'd first like to again draw everyone's attention to where you can obtain Wendy's and Pat's contact information. If you're online now, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. There you'll be returned to the home page, which has Wendy's and Pat's email addresses and phone numbers. And they said it, so go ahead and email them all the questions you have. Also, just to clarify something, on the bottom of that same homepage, you'll find two additional items. One is the link to additional resources, which Wendy and Pat referred to. If you tried to click that URL in the PowerPoint presentation, you probably didn't go anywhere. You need to cut that or copy that and paste it into your browser, or if you're on the Internet homepage for this webcast, you can click the additional resources button, which will take you to those references that were mentioned today. The second item at the homepage is the seminar feedback form, and again, we do ask you to consider completing this form, which will help us improve future webcasts. Now we do have some time for additional questions. As usual, I will start with the one submitted online, and the first question comes from Garnett in Virginia, who represents a foundation, the 509A3 organization, which is not in a position to develop a membership base. And Garnett is asking for some advice on how do we tap the individual donors group. And secondarily, do you have any suggestions about donor databases and what should be tracked?
How about Pat on that one?
Pat, take that one.
How to raise funding without a membership base. As I mentioned earlier, you can tap into major donors even, although it's hard to do without a membership base, by simply trying to locate individuals that you know believe in what you do, that you are have the ability to give, and also with which you have some kind of a contact. For a foundation, and I'm not sure whether this is a foundation that gives away money or just a nonprofit which is calling itself a foundation, which some do, but I think following some of the same principles that we've talked about, thinking about your mission, who your services benefit and who might be your most reliable prospects is probably the way to go. There may be corporations that would support your work, or there may be other foundations even that really your work benefits. The second half of the question had to do with
any advice for what you should track in a database, and perhaps any suggestions for standard databases?
Well, that question, I do have some information about that. I think rather than going into it here, it might be better to have you email me, and I'd be happy to mail you some information about what to track and also some potential databases other than the ones that Wendy already has mentioned. And I can also put you in touch with an individual who specializes in nonprofit databases and can probably really address your questions more specifically.
Six.
Pat, can I add, Ron, can I add a little bit?
Hit that. Would they go blank and then you have Ron?
Hold on 1 second before you do that, Wendy. Could I ask everyone to make sure that they have muted their phones? Thank you. Go ahead, Wendy.
I was just going to say that the slide that I had on databases, in the presenter notes, there are several websites that you might check out that could be helpful. The other question about not having a membership base per se, the Roaring Fork Conservancy was telling me that they do not have a traditional membership base. They don't renew their members on an annual calendar, but they still give them plenty of opportunity to give and to participate. You can do it without a traditional membership base. if you pay attention to the basics and you're still building your in-house list and giving them many different ways to participate and give.
Okay, thanks, Wendy. We'll now open up the lines for questions via phone. If you have a question, please identify yourself and say where you're calling from. I'm sorry, speaker, could you do that again, please?
This is Mary in Connecticut.
Yes, Mary in Connecticut.
We are a small nonprofit. We are trying to increase our membership base so we're less dependent on government grants and foundations and more dependent on membership. However, we're also attempting a capital campaign at the same time, which the board desires to do. How will we pull both of these off with part-time staff?
If I could repeat the question, perhaps for those that didn't hear, I think the gist of it was we have very little staff and a lot of ambition to spread out and explore the various other elements of funding sources. How do we balance those seemingly conflicting issues?
Nope, it's even more complex than that because the board wishes to undertake a capital campaign at the same time.
Then the board needs to run the capital campaign. Capital campaigns are generally additional to your normal workload, and I don't imagine that they have staffing, they have funds in their staffing budget that could be allocated to the staff time associated with running it with your staff. And if they had the money, they should hire somebody professional to do it because it's not something that your basic office staff is going to be able to do without a lot of specialized training. So, you know, that's what I know it sounds easier to say than to do, but, you know, getting back to your work plan, what is in the job description of your current staff people? If what they want is to hire a capital campaign coordinator, then you have to seriously ask if the people you have on staff have the qualifications to do it.
Great. We have time for one more question over the phone. Who wants to close it out?
Yes, Jeff, calling from Southwest Ohio. Wendy and Pat, thank you for all your information. It's been very useful. But do you have any tracking of funding for groups that have one individual event per year to try to fund versus groups that are sustainable all year long and have, like, monthly meetings and monthly events? Is there any tracking of whether funding is more is easier to get if you have a single event per year or whether you're doing multiple events per year?
Well, when you say tracking, I guess I've suggested that we have a vast database of information, and it is sort of a niche market. I can't say that we've been able to track on every variable. What we do have is data that shows that a number of strategies seems to be the best approach and the most sustainable approach. If you put all your eggs in one basket, you know the risks. Obviously, if you have a rainstorm and your event is wiped out, that can be really hard on you. So I think our experience, our professional experience, has been a number of events over the year with a couple that are big fundraisers and plenty of backup with other strategies to reach those same donors.
Okay, thank you.
You know what? I had everything muted. I'm sorry. At this time, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Wendy and Pat for presenting and encourage folks to check out EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum at www.epa.gov/watershedforum if you would be interested in discussing more issues related to this topic. We also encourage folks to return to www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast for notices about future webcasts. And speaking of future webcasts, our next webcast is scheduled for April 19th. Gail Killam will give a presentation tentatively entitled Opportunities for Citizen Involvement in the Clean Water Act. Gail will describe how citizens and organizations can make a difference in their watersheds through an improved understanding of the Clean Water Act and other national laws addressing water resources. So please mark your calendars for this sure-to-be-intriguing webcast, April 19th. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you very much.